Alan Jones, in his book, The Soul's Journey, wrote this: "It is often our mistakes that actually get us going on our spiritual journey. Error is turned into pilgrimage." Do you find that to be true in your life? That some of the greatest lessons, some of the greatest developments happen because you messed up? Painful lessons, but memorable, life-shaping, character-developing lessons that come out of our failures that don't make us a failure. They're just failings on a greater journey of pilgrimage. So today we're going to have a brief look at part of my pilgrimage in my life. It is an interesting road, at times a painful road, at times a very shameful road, but at times a very joyful road. And so we'll be sharing all of those things with you today as we look at what it means to be a part of recovery. What a great idea for a church to have a recovery Sunday. I love that idea. And to be a part of that is a real privilege. So, a little bit about my life. I was born at an early age. I came into an intact family, which today is sort of questionable. You've got a mom and a dad that are together. They love each other. They have five offspring, so I'm the oldest of five. I am the favorite because my picture's higher on the refrigerator, so you know I'm the oldest. So we are actually Southern family. Mom from Tennessee, Pulaski. Anybody know Pulaski, a little place? Dad from Little Rock. They met at David Lipscomb. Dad said, "I'm a confirmed bachelor, going to get through here, get my bachelor's degree, and probably move off and hunt and fish the rest of my life." That lasted about 1 week. Saw about a 5-foot, beautiful, green-eyed beauty walking across campus. And for 4 years, he dated that woman and finally married her. So that bachelorhood ended. They get married. Dad is a preacher, and he wants to do mission work. But my brother is born with all kinds of physical situations and illnesses, so we can't go across seas. So we decide to move to Wisconsin. We move to a stateside mission work, and we're up there in the late 50s and all through the 60s. And that's sort of interesting because Churches of Christ back then, there were about six in the state of Wisconsin. And so you sort of feel, you know, separated, isolated, different. But that was sort of the family that I grew up in. Good family, intact family. Dad was later asked to move out to West Texas to teach in a preacher development training school to use his experiences. So we moved to West Texas. By the way, moving from Wisconsin to West Texas, I don't recommend that. Things like trees, water, hills, they all go. They just disappear. So it was sort of a radical experience. Anyway, we moved out there, and overall, good people, good experience. I graduated. Somebody says, "You want to go to Texas Tech or Lubbock Christian?" I said, "Absolutely not. I'm Lubbock in the rearview mirror. I'm out of here." So I went up to Arkansas, went to school there, enjoyed my college career, decided I wanted also to get in ministry, got married to a sweet little gal from Arkansas. We had three wonderful kids. I wanted them to be able to sing, so I particularly chose a girl who came from a singing family, and sure enough, all our kids love to sing, so that's a part of our heritage. I wanted to be involved them in athletics because I loved athletics, so two out of the three, just phenomenal, way past their dad, all state folks and everything. So all of this is good. I move to a church in Texas, start working with youth. We're growing. They asked me to start preaching. We're growing. We build a new church building. I mean, this is like the fairy tale, right? This is the way it's supposed to be. This is plan A. And it all just sort of unfolded real easily. Too easily. Now, it wasn't that I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth. We didn't have a lot of money. But things that I just took for granted, I didn't appreciate. I inherited relationship. I inherited a family's name. I inherited faith. But I didn't own it. Do you know what the difference between innocence and virtue is? You ever thought about that? Now, I have 12 grandchildren. The 11th and 12th, the 11th one just turned 1 years old. The 12th one is going to be turning one soon. These little gals are simply a sack of sugar. That's all they are. And they got these pictures of the 11th one as she's starting to inhale this cake. And she's all in pink and she's got pearls on. And these pictures are just adorable. She didn't have a scar on her. She didn't have a wrinkle on her. She didn't have anything but cake on her. That's it. And pearls. That's innocence. Now, virtue, on the other hand, virtue is different than innocence. Virtue is when you come to a bump in the road and you're tested and you pass the test. That's when you develop virtue. It's the strength of innocence. Well, as I would later find out, I had innocence, but I didn't have a lot of virtue. In the very first book of the Bible, we are introduced to an innocent setting. Genesis chapter 1 and 2, this incredible picture of this great benevolent God with all this phenomenal planning and power and providence. And so he creates all these days and he places all these events in sequence, and everything seems to be going just fine. There's an innocence about this. There's a formation out of the dirt of a man and a woman, and they walk around. They don't even have to go shopping. They're just walking around in this type of paradise. And there's this innocence. But you know what? In chapter 3, that's interesting that in this innocent paradise, there exists a snake. Have you ever thought about that? In the paradise, a snake is there. Now, my wife would say that's anything but a paradise. All things snake, nothing paradise. Chapter 3, the innocent husband and wife are introduced to a bump in the road. And they have a choice to make. Creator said, if you eat of this, something's going to happen you've never experienced before. You will die. Serpent says, well, you know this story, don't you? Did God say you're going to die? You're not going to die. God's just a little bit, well, he's self-protecting. He's looking and saying, if you eat of this, you're going to become like him. I'm not telling you the truth. And then Eve and Adam had a choice to make. Do I believe the Creator? Or in my own decision, it looks good. It sure seems like it would taste good. And why not? Why not? When God walks into the garden and Adam and Eve are covered in shame and in fear because they've done something that now they never can go back on. When God begins asking, what happened? Why did you choose that? The woman says, I was deceived by the serpent. We are introduced to a personality by his primary trait, his life work. All of his purpose and existence from his rebellion from his Creator is summed up in one word: deception. In the last book of the Bible, in Revelation chapter 20, John gives us a future look as to the result or the end of that personality. And twice in that chapter, he calls the devil the deceiver. So from the first mention in Genesis to the last book in the Bible, and all through the history of millions and millions of people, Satan deceives. That's his job. By the way, he's pretty good at it, isn't he? Should I ask the question, anybody in here that hasn't been deceived yet? We know the answer to that, don't we? So here I am, young buck, great young family, church is growing, things are hopping, and there's an innocence, there's a development, there's recognition. And there's a growing arrogance. Look what's happening in my ministry. Look what's going on at my church. Look at my beautiful family. And so forth and so on. There is a fellow that lived in the 1500s, a Roman Catholic priest. His name is Saint Philip Neri. Listen to what he says. Humility is the safeguard of chastity. In the matter of purity, there is no greater danger than not fearing the danger. For my part, when I find a man secure of himself and without fear, I give him up for lost. I am less alarmed for one who is tempted and who resists by avoiding situations than for one who is not tempted and who is not careful to avoid situations. When a person puts himself in a situation saying, "I shall not fall," it is almost an inevitable sign that he will fall, and with great injury to his soul. Marie and I are in Chattanooga yesterday. We are being hosted by a couple who have lived there most of their life, and they're showing us part of the Civil War monuments in history. So we go out to the Lookout Mountain area, into that great area where they fought that great battle at Chickamauga, and all of the interesting historical artifacts that mark that horrendous time in the history of our country. And we watch a film that talks about this battle. Thousands of Americans fighting each other, slaughtering husbands, boys, of the same country, sometimes of the same city. They were talking about the battle around Lookout Mountain, and they said that the Union Army pretty well had this thing secure, except for some unexplainable reason, two divisions just disappeared, and there was a hole in the line of defense. And where do you think the opposing army went? Right through that hole. That's what effective military commanders do, don't they? They find the weakness and they exploit the weakness. Did you know that in the Ten Commandments, there's only one commandment that's actually mentioned twice, a sin, if you will, that's mentioned twice? You shall not commit adultery. you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Apparently, God, in his wisdom, knew the tendencies of his creation. And he said clearly, you must not do this. Now, he's not a mean God. He's not a God that's trying to hide all the fun and the pleasure and the temptation and what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. He's not that kind of God, really. He's said to be that kind of God. You know, puritanical, out of date, oppressive. He's got an ego. He's got to set the boundaries. You shall not. He's not, as I would find out. Just like any good dad does, sometimes you build fences. Why? Because if you run out in the road, or as I was 2 years old and running out of our yard up on the rail tracks as the train was coming, and my mother saw that and screamed and ran out there and grabbed me. Why would? Because when we leave the boundaries of safety, we're in trouble. That's why. Over a 15-year period, starting in the middle 30s of my life, early 30s, I started walking away from everything that was good. But nobody knew it. Quietly, deceptively. For 15 years, I became not only a hypocrite and a liar, a fraud, I became a multiple adulterer. But I had an image to keep, right? And I was good at it. Because once you practice a skill, you develop capabilities. And so I became freed from this God of law to see what was on the other side, if it really was greener grass. As it turned out, I became the best hypocrite that I knew. Nobody was better than me. I could teach a class with the best of them, and then I could break my vows, dishonor my God through the rest of the week. And I did. There's a passage when I began reading and thinking about this, when I was beginning to get my moral sobriety back years later, that really just stuck in my spiritual craw. In 2 Peter, Peter is trying to address not necessarily the onslaught of people's faith from the enemy outside, but from those who have slipped inside the family of faith. And he's warning the people he's writing to that there are people in your midst, in your church, in your congregation, that are involved in a lifestyle that is going to make you rotten to the core. You know, there's some beautiful apples. I got a son and his wife and family live up in Colorado Springs, and they just went apple picking. It's a great time to get all these apples. And you can get some of the most beautiful apples. You look at that thing and you say, man, that is just, isn't that gorgeous? Shines and it looks plump and juicy. And you take a bite into it, and what do you find? Oh, you've been there, right? That old squiggly thing. And the only thing worse than biting into and finding a worm is finding half a worm. Just saying. Peter is writing with his heart on his sleeve to people. This is vital, he says. This is, you need to hear this. And I'm saying this to you today. You need to hear this. Second Peter chapter 2. And he says in verse 13, their idea of pleasure is to carouse in broad daylight, their blots and blemishes, reveling in their pleasures while they feast with you. Here's people that eat with you at the Lord's Supper. Here's people that come into your homes. Here's people that share life with you. But in their inner being, they're dark and dank and dangerous. In verse 14, he said, with eyes full of adultery, they never stop sinning. They seduce the unstable. They're experts in greed. An accursed brood. And that's the term talking about baby snakes, right? Eyes full of adultery. You know what that phrase literally means in the original language? It means on a continual basis, these men could not look at a woman without undressing her and taking her to bed. Any woman he looked at. And do you know why that hit me so strongly? Because that's what I was doing. There was no woman safe in my mind. What was really disappointing for me, that what was initially pleasurable began losing its pleasure. What was exciting because it was out of bounds sort of became mundane. Jesus in John chapter 8 makes an interesting statement. A man is enslaved by what he sins. A man is enslaved by how he sins. And instead of being free, I became enslaved. The deceiver said, Steve, free up. And guess what? He did his job, and he seduced the seducer. Later in that chapter, in verse 19 of 2 Peter 2, Peter says, they promise them freedom while they themselves are slaves of depravity. For a man is a slave to whatever has mastered him. When I began to get a glimpse of who I had become and where I was, I read a book called Addicted to Love by Stephen Otterburn. Otterburn has written several books that chronicle out of his own experiences and failures this journey into where he shouldn't have gone. And at the end of this book, Addicted to Love, he has a 100-question summary. And it's sort of like, if you are, and then he'll fill in the blank, then you are an addict. If you do this consistently, you are an addict. 100 questions. I made a 75 on that test. 3 out of 4, that was me. I couldn't believe what I had become. It was like eating dessert without any meat or vegetables or fruit. And when people do that, what do you become? I find it interesting that 15 years ago, 16 years ago now, this very month, the most cataclysmic attack on our country took place, right? Everyone remembers 9/11, don't you? 2 weeks after 9/11 took place, my 9/11 took place, when this fantasy world, this fake world, all came crashing down. I want to share with you some takeaways from my experience. I hope you'll listen carefully to these. Number one, as opposed to the devil, I discovered that God always tells the truth. Always. Are there some things that God can't do? Can he make a rock big enough he can't lift it? I don't get into those philosophical discussions, but I'll tell you what I do. I realize there are some things that God can't do. I believe in one of the letters to Titus, the only letter we have, Paul said in the opening chapter, to God, from God, who cannot lie. He can't lie. What's that movie? What is it about the lying? Liar, Liar? Remember that little thing? I cannot lie. God can't lie. So what we have here then is a record of a God of truth who tells it like it is. We may not like it, but we desperately need it. In a culture where the word truthiness from Stephen Colbert has now been incorporated into our dictionary. Did you know that? Truthiness, this from my own impressions, from my own world, from my own perceptions, this is what's real. This postmodern type way of finding what's real and what's accurate, what's reality. As opposed to that and the devil, God always tells the truth. There's a little passage in the Old Testament, in the wisdom literature, that I hope all of you, but particularly you men, will read. Just make a little note of this. Proverbs chapters 5, 6, and 7. Now, Proverbs is an interesting collection of wisdom sayings. It's from a mother and a father who are about to launch their kids. Isn't that a glorious day when the kids leave? I love to have you, but come back and visit. See you. So that's what happens. They're launching the kids. And this is sort of a... And here, I want you to take this with you as you go. This will help you on your journey. Proverbs 5, 6, and 7 concentrate on a dad talking to his boy about wild women and wicked men. He said, you need to be careful about these two folks. Because if you get in a group of wild guys, you start acting crazy. And if you get in a group of wild ladies, you really start acting crazy. And so he just lays out in beautiful, clear detail the truth about these relationships. A year ago last summer, I asked my three children, now grown in their 30s, I told them, I said, now Proverbs has 31 chapters. I'm planning on reading a chapter a day in the month of July. Would you like to read with your dad? They live not close to me, but we were doing this online. And just sort of comment on your experiences. And we did. I've now compiled that booklet, took all the comments from our emails and everything and compiled it and gave it to them for Christmas, called A July to Remember. And when it got to chapter 5 of Proverbs, I made this candid statement. I said, kids, your dad almost didn't suggest that we do this together because of the recollection of a former life of your father and how that impacted your mom and your life. But this is truth. And as the dad in Proverbs 5, 6, and 7 is doing to his son and children, so this dad wants to do with my kids. It's one of the most precious experiences we've ever done together. Proverbs 5, 6, and 7 talks about the cost of unfaithfulness. It is staggering. Let me share with you the very first page in my journal, which I began doing when my world came crashing down around me. It was a spiritual discipline that I needed to do because it taught me to reflect, to think, to remember, and to tell the truth, because I had lost the ability to speak that language. You ever been around people like that? You don't know whether to believe them or not? What a miserable experience that is. I didn't know how to tell the truth. First page, September the 29th, 2001, 9:52 p.m. All tears have been spent. From 6 o'clock this morning, speaking to my wife's mother and father, to 8 o'clock, talking to the business attorney, to 10 o'clock, talking to my boss, to 2:30 in the afternoon, talking to my oldest child, to 3 o'clock, talking to my youngest son. I'm simply going through the motions. My wife is growing in fierce anger. We very well may be no more. I wish I could cry, but every drop is gone. I just ache over the sense of utter shame and the loss and the pain, the impending loneliness, the humiliating job hunt, and then facing my mother and my father. The seducer didn't tell me that part. Somehow he overlooked that in our discussions. Somehow the reality of the staggering sense of loss was not found in that fantasy world. The cost of unfaithfulness is staggering. At the end of Proverbs chapter 7 in verse 23, listen to the word of God. All at once, the foolish young man followed her like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping into a noose, till an arrow pierced the young man's liver, and he did not know that it would cost him his life. Cost. Takeaway number one, God tells the truth. Number two, the cost of unfaithfulness is staggering. And yet, I've been invited to come and talk to you today. As my wife and I prayed before we came over here this morning, I reflected with my God, thinking, I couldn't 16 years ago begin to imagine that I would have the privilege and opportunity to do what I'm doing today, where I was 16 years ago, this month. But by God's grace, I'm here. And if you'll come and bear with me through the sermon, I'll talk more about how that happens. That's yet to come. Takeaway number three. When you allow God into your broken world, He offers you something. It's called hope for your future. Not optimism. Hope. Now this afternoon, Marie and I will be talking with, I hope, a number of you about how to walk with people. What a privilege that is. We're going to talk about the difference between optimism and hope. But if you allow God into your broken world, He will give you hope. If you believe that your issue or issues, your addiction, whatever you want to call it, your sin, let's call it what it is. If you believe that those things are bigger than your God, you need to get a better vision of your God. I remember sitting on my sister's bed, because I didn't have a house anymore. Oh yeah, that's part of the cost of unfaithfulness. I remember sitting there one morning reading in the 104th Psalm. And this is what I read. There is a sea, vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond number, living things, both large and small. On this sea go the ships. And the Leviathan whom you formed frolics there. Now, you may not be up on the Leviathan. We don't use that term very often. So, quick lesson. In the ancient Near Eastern world, these mythical opposing forces to your life, the sun, the rain, the enemies. You had names for all of these enemies. And the Leviathan was this monster in the deep. So if you went on a boat and you didn't come back, people thought that the Leviathan ate you. What the writer says is, God made the sea. God made the sea. He made everything in the sea. And the hugest, most powerful opposition to anything of order and safety, the Leviathan, frolics at his feet. Just like a little lap dog. Like a little poodle that comes in and plays around, yip, 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 around the feet. That's what the Leviathan is to our God. If your vision of God is not as big as it should be, you need to get a better vision of God. If your vision of the heart of God is not as big as it needs to be, you need to enlarge the heart of God. You need to see His heart. Luke chapter 15, we have the great story of the prodigal son. And at the beginning of that, Luke talks about Jesus intentionally eating with sinners. That's what they're called, sinners. Hey, Steve Kell, visiting from Dallas, he's a sinner. That's how he's introduced. Well, it's the truth. He's a forgiven sinner, but he's a sinner. Jesus wanted to eat with these people. My people. Me. And the teachers and the Pharisees said, this man welcomes sinners. Does your God do that? Because my God does. Oh, that's good stuff. Well, we need to wrap this up. All of this really actually comes down to a trust issue. Trust issue. Who are you going to believe? Now, I did this little exercise with my niece when I was living at my sister's house. We would watch some TV, and when the commercials came on, we would take them apart. She would watch. She was about 9 years old. And I'd say, okay, Alyssa, what was true about that commercial? If you use that kind of toothpaste, are you going to have the best-looking, smartest, and kindest boyfriend in the world? Is that the way that works? Well, I don't know. Are you going to believe what the world teaches as reality and true? Are you going to believe the seducer who says, you just need to chuck all this stuff with God? Did God say this? That's not true. Or are you going to believe the one personality in all of existence who cannot lie? You have to make a decision about that. I had to make a decision about that. Despite my feelings, despite my experiences, despite my desires, who are you going to trust? The deceiver or the redeemer?